From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a box. The box is marked simply None. N-O-N-E. We're talking about recent surveys asking Americans about their religious affiliation. A record number of Americans now self-identify as non-religious. A none box there. Roughly 23%, according to Harris polling. And for the millennial generation, Pew Research finds that 35% are nuns. That puts the number of Americans currently self-identifying as non-religious at around 50 million. But that doesn't mean that all of the nuns are atheists. It could mean a variety of ideas: atheists, agnostics, skeptics, spiritual but not religious. You get the idea. But the rise of the nuns should mean more comfort in modern American society for atheists and skeptics alike there. But writing for Scientific American, Michael Shermer notes a few things here. First of all, he writes, quote, "This shift away from the dominance of any one religion is good for a secular society whose government is structured to discourage catch basins of power from building up and spilling over into people's private lives," end quote. And yet, this rise in population of non-religious Americans does not translate into a rise in non-religious American policymaking. Much of the most influential policy in this country is debated and passed by people from both major political parties who are loudly, proudly religious. That doesn't mean that they are governing based on religious texts or exclusively or at all. Some are. But for atheists, it's a kind of dichotomy. There are more of them, but they're often left out of big debates on policy. The recent conversations about Roe v. Wade are just one example. And if you want a surefire way to sink your campaign for office, come out as an atheist and see how that goes. This hour, a conversation with a panel of nuns about that dichotomy. Hello to our guest this hour. Dan Courtney, did you ever think you'd be called a nun?
It never occurred to me, no.
Oh, N-O-N-E. Dan's co-founder of Young Skeptics in years past. He's an atheist activist. We've talked to him many times. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Thank you, Evan.
Hello to Carol Hope, who is organizer for Secular Humanists of Rochester. Carol, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Also, hello to Tony Karakashian. Tony's a cybersecurity specialist and a skeptic in the nun category, right? Maybe not Sarah. You're the only non-atheist in the crowd today.
I know. I guess it's as close as... Close as you can get without actually happening, but yeah.
Also, hello to Linda Stevens, a member of the atheist community of Rochester and atheist plaintiff in the town of Greece v. Galloway Supreme Court case how long ago now, Linda?
4 years ago.
4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I would have said two. Where does the time go? Thank you for being here. And John Morrell is here, professor emeritus of religious studies at the College of William and Mary and the author of a number of books, including 50 Great Myths About Religions. We got a lot to talk about with you, John. So thanks for taking the time to come all the way into Rochester. Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
I'm going to start with you, John. I mean, as a professor emeritus of religious studies and someone who's, I think not only thought about your own views of the world, but you've had a chance to talk to students over the years. You observe public life. This is a strange kind of question, but let's just start on the 30,000-foot view. Is this a good or a bad time to be an atheist in this country?
It's getting more acceptable, and I think Americans are starting to appreciate that atheism is a reasonable position. This has always been the case in Europe. If you look at polls in Europe, for example, in England, 42% of those polled by the Church of England said they were either atheists or agnostics. 15% claim that they attended church at least once a month, but the church itself does a pew count, and they said it's got to be way under 10%. If you go to France, weekly attendance at Mass in this Catholic country is now at 7%. And those who never go to Mass number 58%. And the number of Catholics who are baptized and under 35 years old who never go to Mass is 71%. So atheism and agnosticism have a much, they're much more popular in Europe. The least religious country in Europe is Sweden, which has an official state church. It's a version of Lutheranism. And everybody until 1996 who was born in Sweden of Swedish parents was automatically registered in that church. 80% of Swedes say they're either convinced atheists or they're not religious. So I think America, in a sense, is catching up with the rest of the civilized world.
And yeah, I think of a conversation, John, I had with a friend last weekend who saw a bumper sticker, and the bumper sticker said, everyone needs Jesus. And he said, you know what? He said, I don't feel like I need Jesus, but I also feel like I couldn't get away with having a bumper sticker on my car that said, no one needs Jesus.
Right, Right.
So there's a difference in sort of public acceptance of ideas right. and how they're displayed, and is what his point was. Do you agree?
I agree completely. No one needs Jesus sounds hostile and nasty and snarky. Everyone needs Jesus sounds warm and fuzzy and friendly.
But to him, it felt condescending and rude.
Right, right, because he had the opposite view.
Okay, all right. Well, that's just one view in his mind of how
right.
what's acceptable and what not in sort of the social sphere. Linda, have you noticed a change at all in how you sort of feel you're perceived, your interactions with people, how overt you can feel about your atheism?
My experience on the Supreme Court, one of the things
and we do were, me a favor, get right close to that microphone for me. Go ahead.
One of the things that we were asked to speak about today was how atheists are treated these days. And my experience on the Supreme Court, I was involved in the Town of Greece case in which the town supervisor brought in pastors every month to give a Christian prayer before the town board meetings. And myself and Susan Galloway, who is Jewish, objected to that because it felt one of our arguments in the case was that we were disrespected and we were not treated like the other people who were Christians. So it got me to thinking that the Supreme Court has changed. Back in the 1960s, the Supreme Court seemed to be more acceptable or more protective of atheists. Back in the 1960s, the Supreme Court ruled that prayers in schools could be banned, and they ruled that prayer reading in schools could be banned. And Madeline Murray O'Hare, who was an atheist and who was known as the most hated woman in America because of her atheism, lodged that complaint to the Supreme Court. But anyway, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. In the case of our complaint, the Supreme Court ruled against us, and they really insulted us. You know, Justice Kennedy, for example, said we had thin-skinned. If we were thin-skinned if we complained about these Christian prayers, you know, just suck it up. In fact, this is what Justice Kennedy said. He said, adults often encounter speech they find disagreeable, and it's not an Establishment Clause violation anytime a person experiences a sense of affront from the expression of contrary religious views in a legislative forum. And if you'd contrast that with what happened in that recent Supreme Court decision having to do with the Christian baker who refused to bake a cake for a gay couple's marriage. In that case, Justice Kennedy was very very worried that they were offended by some of the things that the Civil Rights Commission had said during the proceedings before it landed in the Supreme Court. He said the Christian baker was disrespected. So it was completely different. It was all right for, according to Justice Kennedy, for atheists to be disrespected, but not for this Christian baker. That's one of the things I observed.
Well, Dan, as someone who has lived for many years now without any grounding values, how do you get by? I'm mostly kidding. And I'm being flippant to raise a point here. There still is this divide among religious and non-religious that says you can't possibly have values. I think one of the most important things that we can do going forward, no matter where we are, whether you're in the nuns or not, whether you're among the many religions of the world, is to understand that people of all different backgrounds can have values.
Of course.
And I want to ask you in your own observance of, because, you know, Linda's bringing up cases and the way we talk about, well, suck it up, just deal with this, versus different cases where, well, you know, are atheists to be offended? There's sort of this expectation that atheists will stay either silent or not challenge other values. And as an example, I wonder if you're seeing this change at all in the way that when people run for office, they'll often talk about my faith, my grounding faith, that's a good thing. Voters will say, I want someone with, you know, religious grounding of values. Right. But if you say, I want someone who's not religious because I think that shows poor thinking, that's viewed as rude.
Sure.
You know, and I wonder if you feel more comfortable talking about that with friends in the public sphere?
In fact, I encounter this quite often. Even people that are non-religious very often consider religion to be the grounding of their values and their morality. What's interesting, however, is, especially when it comes to our government or the founding of the country is not founded on Christian values. And I'll give you a particular example. One of the founding principles of this country is individual responsibility. So, for example, in the Constitution, it says there shall be no retainer of blood, I think is the terminology, which basically means that your children or other relatives will not be punished for your transgressions. It's only applies to the individual. Well, religion, at least Christianity, is explicitly uses vicarious atonement, for example, on many different fronts, which means that your progeny very often could be held accountable for what you do. So there's a disconnect between secular enlightenment values, which is what the country is founded upon, in which we all share our sense of morality, and those values that are promoted by religion. So I'm very willing to have that conversation with people that say, listen, you get your values from religion. I can very clearly and confidently say, no, you get your values from secular enlightenment thinking, which actually goes against the grain of what religious doctrine teaches.
And I wonder how those conversations go. I mean, do you risk losing friendships? Are you more confident today than in years past that you can sort of civilly hold those discussions? Or is it not going in that direction?
No, I think it certainly takes practice to have civil discussions, whether it's religion or politics or whatever that happens to be, with people that hold the opposite opinions. But it can be done civilly if you stick to the facts, if you acknowledge them as a human being that has value. When it comes to conservative versus liberal, for example, an analogy I often use is, I use a baseball analogy. I say, if you're on first base, you want to get to second base. That's the objective. That would be a progressive position, is to try to get to second base. If you're a conservative, you feel safe standing on first base. But there has to be some tension. If you just willy-nilly run to second base, you're going to get tagged out. If you just constantly stand on first base, you're never going to score a run. So there has to be this push-pull. You need to have a dichotomy of opinions that work against each other. It's the same with religion. It's same with politics. So if you start from the point of everybody's position has value in society, and you can value them as a person, you can have that civil discussion.
Carol, do you feel more comfortable or less these days in talking about your views?
I feel much more comfortable. And I was pretty much in the closet. I've been an atheist my whole life, but I never really used the word. And I credit Linda with giving me the courage to come out of the closet. I saw her on television when the Supreme Court came down with their decision, and she was standing on the steps of the Supreme Court and said, atheists need to come out of the closet so it will become more acceptable. And that was when I did that. And many times when I'm with other people and I mention that I'm an atheist, they will sort of whisper to me, I am too.
Yes, interesting you bring that up. I just, for the first time, watched a movie that I think is 12 years old now. Sean Penn played Harvey Milk. And Harvey Milk, in his activism in the 1970s before he was assassinated in San Francisco, would urge fellow gay people to come out of the closet, not just for themselves, but as a duty to other gay people. And that has been controversial, not just in Harvey Milk's day, but even today. It's hard to tell gay friends who may not feel comfortable, you know, come out for everybody's sake. Well, Harvey Milk did that. And I don't know that it's a perfect parallel, but I think there is, to some degree, when you talk to people who are atheists, they feel like that there is some sort of a stigma that it can be difficult. So what was the difficult thing for you? What were you most fearful of in your years in the closet as an atheist?
Well, the stigma. And I think part of the stigma of atheism arose in the 1950s when atheism was thought of as those godless communists. And I don't know whether it started then, but I think there is a lot of connection there. I want to say, too, about bumper stickers. I have two bumper stickers on my car. One says, I believe in good, and the other says, good without a God. And I've suggested this to some of my fellow atheists and humanists, and they're a little afraid to do that. But my tires haven't been slashed yet.
Did
Did your decision to quote-unquote come out impact any of the relationships that you feared would be harmed?
Yes.
It did?
Yes. I had a couple of very religious Catholic friends. Now, I consider a person who goes to Mass every day as being very religious. And I first mentioned that I didn't believe in an afterlife, and she really didn't know how to handle that because she knew I was a good person, and she just couldn't believe that a good person would not believe in God. And it was sort of a cognitive dissonance on her part. She really didn't know how to handle it. And it never got to hostility, but the relationship was never as warm as it had been previously.
I'm sorry to hear that. You want to add to that, don't you?
I'd like to add a comment about why it's so hard to have civil discussions about religion. If you think of how people acquire religious beliefs, it's quite different from other beliefs that they have. Most people get their religious beliefs at about age 4 or 5, and they get it from mommy and daddy. They wouldn't think of asking, well, is this true? Or is there another way to look at the world? Or instead of Yahweh, the God of the Bible, might Shiva or Woden be the real God? You don't think critically about religion when you absorb it. And for most people, you just keep the religion that you had when you were 4 or 5. That's why most Americans are some version of Christianity. I do a thought experiment with my students in which I ask them, suppose there was a mix-up at the hospital in the maternity ward when you were born, and suppose that they got you mixed up with the kid next to you who was from a Hindu family, and suppose you went home with the Hindu family, what religion would you be now? And my students, who are many Southern Baptist, Catholic, and others, say, well, I'd probably be Hindu. And I'd say, well, would you think differently about Hinduism than you do? And they'd say, of course. I'd be completely convinced. When you look at the religions in the world, that most people don't appreciate how many there are. The World Christian Encyclopedia, which is a handbook for missionaries, counts 10,000 major groupings. One of those 10,000 is called Christianity. Subdivided Christianity comes out 34,000, that's 30, denominations or sects. And these sects, of course, disagree with each other. They disagree with each other, for example, about whether all human beings are completely depraved, about whether Jesus founded a papacy, and countless other things. And I asked my students, what if there were 34,000 chemistries or 34,000 biologies? The world would be totally confusing. Now, most people, as I said, don't compare and contrast all the possibilities and then choose one. They simply pick up their religion from mommy and daddy the way they pick up their language. This is why it's so threatening. If I haven't thought about something that's so basic to me as my religion, then when somebody else comes along with a completely different view, suppose they're Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist, I just don't know how to respond because I haven't thought it through. Martin Luther King had a wonderful quotation. He said, you can't reason somebody out of something they haven't been reasoned into. And for most people, that's what religion is like. And this is why it's hard to have a civil discussion, because most people just don't have the basic mental framework to do an open discussion.
Yeah, so before I turn to Tony, and I saw Tony especially reacting, but let me follow up with John for 1 second here, because on the subject of the way you talk to your students and how they view things, it is certainly true that most people in this world, as adults, are whatever religion they were raised as. Obviously, there's some movement. But that's the majority of people. And for all the thousands of religions that there have ever been, you'd have to really hit the parental lottery that to be born into the one true one. I mean, but I don't think most people think of it that way. And I don't mean to be belittling.
No.
I mean, it's an interesting thought. And I'm not dismissing that maybe there is one true one and maybe someone was born into it. And that's very fortunate.
Right.
But they don't think of it that way.
Right.
When you ask them to think of it that way, I want to just ask you this, John. I feel like there's only a couple of roads that you can go down. You can go down the road that says, yep, I hit the lottery. There are thousands of religions. Only one is true. I was raised in the one that is true. Good for me. They could say, you know, I recognize that everybody's usually whatever they're raised as, but that's okay because, you know, it's not that important to them to get specific on the text, the doctrine. This sect believes this. This sect believes that.
Right.
That's not all that interesting or important for whatever reason.
Right.
Or they hold to this idea that, no, if I was raised in a Hindu family, I would still be Christian because that's the true religion. I would find it, right. Which is what just research has indicated almost essentially untrue. Right. So what's usually the response? I mean, I'm
the usual response is not to say much of anything. The way I phrase it is very similar to what you said with the lottery. That's why I smiled when you said lottery. I said, let's suppose that Christianity is on the right track. Okay, let's really narrow the field to Christianity. And there's 34,000 versions of Christianity. So suppose your version, 14,850, and suppose that happens to be exactly right. Suppose every detail is exactly right. How would you know that you'd, to say, well, I know that I'm the right one, you can't follow that up with anything. You can't give any evidence for that. So when I present this to students, most of them start doodling or they Google something else because they don't have a way to respond to that. If you think about this reasonably, if there are 34,000 versions of Christianity and Christianity is one of 10,000 possible religions, and you just happen to be in one of them and you just got that from your parents, there's no justification you can give for being in your tradition, it seems to me. So the response I typically get is shrug shoulders or think of something else.
Yeah, there's a guy named Anthony Magnabosco who does really remarkable work just approaching people and asking them, how confident are you that your belief is true? And a lot of people will say 100%.
Right.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, that's not reasonable.
No. That's one of the difficulties with especially Christianity is their emphasis on faith. If you think of what faith is complete confidence in something that you don't have proof for. If you have a belief, but you just picked it up from...
As you know, John, some Christians would push back and say, no, they have evidence in their own ways. They don't measure evidence the way you do.
Okay.
It's true. Okay. I'm just trying to honor...
Right. What most people who take that line is, they take the strength of their feeling. They say that I know that, for example, Jesus is the Son of God or something like that. I know it. And you ask them, well, how do you know? What evidence, what grounds do you have? If they simply say, I feel this strongly, feeling something strongly isn't proof of anything. Muhammad Atta and the other 19 who flew planes into the World Trade Center were praying up until the very last moment. And Muhammad Atta kept a journal in which he prayed to God to strengthen his faith, to make his faith even stronger. So having faith in something doesn't mean that you're right.
Okay. Well, let's ask Tony. Because Tony had I was watching Tony's face as he talked about talking to kids about this. And I wonder, you're a parent, right?
Yep.
Is this the kind of thing where you leave these discussions out of it? Did you have conversations about skepticism at an early age with kids?
Not yet. So I was mostly nodding about the fact that I'm thinking I grew up in a Catholic household, but we weren't even C&E Catholics. We didn't even go on Christmas and Easter. But I went to Catholic school for two reasons. One, because you needed that moral grounding, but also because according to the Catholic schools, the public schools were dens of iniquity and death and pain, and you didn't want to go there anyway. I grew up in that, but I remember having a conversation with a nun. I think it was in the sixth grade, and honestly, to this day, I can't figure out what it is that she was trying to explain, but she said something along the lines of, fear of God was the greatest love that you could have for him. And perhaps I misinterpreted what she was saying, but we spent a few minutes arguing back and forth, and finally she said, you just got to not question it. You got to just accept it on faith that that's how it works. I said, okay. And being 10, I did. But then a couple months later, the show came on PBS called Cosmos from Carl Sagan. And in one of the episodes, he says, if we're going to challenge our fundamental beliefs as scientists, we have to challenge all of our fundamental beliefs. Does a God exist? Is there a heaven? And so forth. And I thought, same answer. You can do that? I mean, I've always been told you can't do that. What I found more Christianity today is they more are, as long as you believe in God, they're okay with it. So all the different sects and so forth, the ones that I've met so far, and maybe it's just New York Christians, they're all like, no, yes, there's all these differences, and yes, we have these rules that we follow too within our religion, but ultimately, as long as you believe in God, you're getting to heaven. That's the only way you can get in. Nothing else matters. And how do you determine which of those things are important to get you to heaven besides that? And they said, well, you use your moral sense. So you use your moral sense to determine which of the morals that are being taught to you are most moral. Why don't you just go with what's on the moral sense? And why do you need that extra layer of instruction? I don't ever get an answer to that.
But what I think where at least I feel like the conversation has taken us is at least this moment in American society where when we actually start to have just civil conversations, everyone here has talked about whether it's coming out of the closet themselves and talking to friends or talking to students or, you know, talking to people about policy, talking to relatives. It often shuts down when you start asking, well, why do you believe this? Because it feels like a hostile question.
Right. And for me,
I don't think it should, but I also think that it's incumbent on all of us to try to ask that question
right.
in a way that's almost loving and interested.
For me, it's a clarifying question. I need this to answer the question for myself. I need to know.
Yeah. It's not to attack. It's not a Trojan horse that I'm about to attack you. I'm genuinely interested.
You're saying this is how you do that. How does that work?
Yeah.
And I need to understand that in order for me to accept that. But it immediately always goes to, well, why are you just attacking my faith?
Yeah.
And that's not fair.
Have you found any tools to sort of chip away at that?
I usually give up when they say agree to disagree.
It's an assumption of hostility.
Yeah.
It's an assumption of hostility. Okay. Our phone's been ringing, and we're going to get to your calls coming up here. Real briefly, let me just ask all of our guests here. Do you think we are any closer to having an avowed atheist as the president of this country?
I'll say yes.
Yeah.
Dan's going to say yes.
In fact,
Carol looked in.
Maybe.
Carol's eyes went wide, and I thought the assumption was no. But maybe not. Okay, Dan?
Yeah, in fact, I make the case that Bernie Sanders is, although he won't use the title of atheist, he is all but atheistic in his belief. He's more like a Spinoza-esque Jewish person, if you would, in which he basically equates God with the existence of everything. So although he won't use the word, and obviously at this particular point, it would be, you know, death to his campaign, or would have been death during 2016, I think we're close to that point where somebody can actually...
Okay. Let me just, for the sake of the intellectual exercise, let me push back a little. We probably have an atheist president now, but just someone who's intellectually disinterested in it, but had to literally embrace the Bible and say it was his favorite book right ahead of The Art of the Deal
right.
to audiences just to win support. And in so doing, the group of voters in this country that has made the biggest change is evangelicals, who used to say that your private personal conduct would impact your policy, and now they are more likely than anybody to say it doesn't matter, right. which is a remarkable change. So I see you're observing Bernie Sanders,
yes.
but I also see so the way the game had to be played.
He's inadvertently making America great again, just by accident, just by being there.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. The embracing the religion, self-identifying as being Christian, is pragmatically useful. And
sure.
if anybody's willing to do something that's useful, even if it's not part of their core values, it's our current president.
Okay. All right. Well, let me do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back. Let's get some phone calls because we've got some folks who want to join the conversation. And we're talking about this this bifurcated sense that some atheists, I'm certainly not speaking for everybody, may have about modern American public life, where a growing group of Americans self-identify as non-religious, not religious. But when it comes to policymaking and political power holding, it's almost never anyone who is overtly skeptical, atheistic, etc. So we're having that conversation with Dan Courtney, Tony Karakashian, Linda Stevens, Carol Hope, John Morrell. It's a wonderful panel, and we'll come right back with your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, disparities exist when it comes to children with autism, the kind of services, diagnosis, and support they receive. Socioeconomics, race, there are differences, and we're trying to change that. I say we, our society is trying to change that, and some folks who are working in that field are accelerating the efforts. We're going to tell you how next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to stress again that I hope no one listening, no matter what your background is, whether you're a nun or N-O-N-E, whether you're a nun, an N-U-N, religious or not religious. I hope you all feel welcomed to join the conversation. And I hope you feel that you are respected. I think people are to be respected. Ideas are to be debated. And some ideas are more worthy of respect than others, but people are worthy of respect. And I hope everyone feels that way. And I want to just follow up on one more point before we get to our phone calls. Because I asked Tony, you know, when you're encountering people and you're asking, you know, why do you believe what you believe? There is this feeling that this is an inherently hostile question that not just doesn't just challenge an idea, but it challenges a core of who I am. And to John, I'll start with you, and I just want to go around the table real quick before we get to the phone. You're right. People's religion usually comes from parental upbringing at the age of, what you say, 4 or 5 is when it starts to cement. And so it becomes a core of who someone is as they move into adulthood. And they haven't been asked to think about why they believe it. So I understand why it may be viewed as a hostile question, because it's not just challenging an idea. It's challenging, well, this is who I am here. What do you mean? Have you found any way to wear down that fear of hostility? I mean, are there more productive ways to have these conversations?
The best thing I can think of, and this can't be done in a couple of minutes, is to get people to look at completely different cultures. Get them to take a course, for example, in world religions. And I've had so many students who grew up in one tradition, Southern Baptist, Catholic, or whatever, who take a course in world religions that said, wow, I never thought of reincarnation. I never thought of the idea that after you die, you come back as another person. Or I never thought that the world was created and then it was destroyed and then it was this all comes from India and Hinduism. Or just a near religion like Judaism. I taught a course for years, Judaism and Christianity in the modern world. And I showed how the thinkers followed very similar paths. So it's education that is required to get people to open up. But you can't do that in the course of a conversation. If I've said something to you and you feel that it threatens your identity, there's very little I can do other than change the subject or pour another drink to make you relax.
Dan.
Yeah, that's I guess you call it the Socratic method, which is basically you're just asking questions because the person has to come to the decision on their own as to what they believe and what they believe to be true. You can't, anytime you try to tell them, you know, this is right and this is wrong, there's going to be an automatic revulsion against that, and they're going to actually go further in the other direction.
Yeah, they may say to you, well, atheism is your religion, which I know you've heard.
Yeah, and I'll use one of my favorite phrases is atheism is a religion like abstinence is a sex position. It's, you know, simply isn't the case. But regardless, you need to get people thinking and questioning in their own minds what they believe and why they believe it. Excuse me. And in through that, you can eventually, again, it's like John said, it's not one conversation, may not even be 100 conversations. But people are able to change their minds if they can think about what they believe and why they believe it.
Carol, what do you think?
Well, I've gotten involved in a couple of conversations that I regretted. I can't say it went well. And so generally, I try to avoid questioning people about their religion. I only seek to be accepted for my position.
Is that sad to you, though, that you feel like you can't just even ask a genuinely curious question?
No, I
you accept it?
I accept that, yeah.
Okay. Linda?
I think one of the things that change people's minds about atheism, if they see atheists in a more positive light, if they learn about atheists. And one positive thing that came out of the Greece Prayer lawsuit was that suddenly atheists all across the country began giving invocations before their town board meetings. And suddenly, and these were usually on media. The reporters and whatnot were interested in this and put them on TV. Suddenly people were seeing atheists in most cases, in a very positive light. So, as I said, it's happening all over the country, and I even started a Facebook page called After Town of Greece, and I put on there the videos and the news stories about these invocations given by atheists or non-theists of various sorts. So I think that's, You know, if people, if you're closeted and you never talk about this, you know, people will go on thinking what they, you know, want to about atheists. But if you see someone in a positive light, as I said, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Should atheists come out, by the way? Do you think it's important for atheists?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. John?
I thought of something else that I've used with clever people. It doesn't work with very many, but with clever people, I try this. In ancient Rome, one of the first applications of the word atheist was to the Christians. Why was that? Because the Christians didn't believe in Jupiter. They didn't believe in Zeus and Hera and all the other gods, and they certainly didn't believe in Woden and Thor and the Norse gods. In fact, Christians are atheists about almost all the world's
gods. Atheists about thousands of religions.
Yeah. In India, there are 330 million gods. Christians are atheists about all 330 million of those, all the Norse gods, all the Roman gods. They only say there's one, and that god is a very specific god, and his name is Yahweh. A lot of Christians don't even know his name. If you read the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, this Yahweh is a lot like ancient gods in Greece and Rome and Scandinavia, etc., and he does stuff that I think people should question, like the flood. A couple generations after Adam and Eve, he gets upset with the whole world, so he destroys everything. And he says, I'm not just going to destroy all the people, I'm going to destroy all the animals, everything that crawls. He also punishes the descendants of people for what those people did. So Adam, for example, screws up and commits the original sin. And all Western versions of Christianity say that God punished or held responsible everybody who came after Adam. If we tried that today, if I arrested you for what your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother did, you'd say you're crazy. But Christians just accept the idea that all of us inherit Adam's original sin. One count of how many people are killed in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, by God, is 2 million plus. So Christians are atheists about all the gods in the world except for Yahweh. And it seems to me there's really good reason to question Yahweh for the same reason you question Thor and Shiva and Vishnu and all the others.
And Poseidon. Yeah, there's a fascinating new book by Bart Ehrman called The Triumph of Christianity. And I'd never thought about this as a math issue, but think about this. Paganism, which was dominant in its day, what people could believe in 80 gods, you could believe in 100, 150, 1,000. You could have a god of commerce, you could have a god for your town, a god of the dinner table, all kinds. But not everybody believed all the same. It kind of didn't matter. Some, you know, different communities believe different things. Now, let's say there's people in a public square, there's 90 people. And John and I show up in town and we say, look, people of town, you're all pagans, but let's do this. I have a new pagan religion. It's the god of the microphone. We're going to call it Dawson. You should worship it. It's great. And it's going to make you a better public speaker if you put Dawson, the god of the microphone, in your house. And John says, no, I believe in Yahweh. Jesus Christ was divine, one true God. 90 people on the public square, 30 think, nah, neither one of them was convincing. I'm going to keep believing what I believed in. 30 think, Evan's right. Let's do the god of the microphone. I'm going to add it to the dozens I already believe in. And 30 think, well, John's right. I'm going to become a Christian. It wasn't just an equal split here. Those 30, one-third of the town, are now no longer pagans at all. They are monotheists. And over time, that destroyed paganism. Adding my microphone god didn't destroy anything. It just added to a big pile. So it became a math question. And monotheism, and Paul especially, who was a tremendously successful evangelist, helped change the world because of just the math question. It was fascinating stuff. The really interesting book, it's called The Triumph of Christianity by Bart Ehrman, if you want to check it out. It's out now. Let's grab some phone calls. Barry in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Barry.
Hello. My name is Barry Swan. I'm the leader of Beth Haskalah, which is the Rochester Society for Humanistic Judaism, and we are secular humanists. We are Jews who are immersed in our Jewish culture and heritage and values, and we live them as secular humanists. We do celebrate Jewish holidays, the Chag holidays and Hanukkah, and we have a vegan Seder, and we do this as secular humanists interpreting what really has happened in history. We have a whole series of Jewish role models that we use each year, such people as Spinoza, Betty Friedan, Carl Sagan, Maurice Sendak, Einstein, of course, Jonas Salk. And we live our lives as secular humanists, but with a Jewish framework, understanding the history of Jews. And Carol mentioned Good Without God. That came from Rabbi Greg Epstein, who was ordained through our movement. He's now the humanist chaplain at Harvard. And he talks about the fact that we're raised by adults who are secular humanists. We use our own knowledge and experience to judge things and to live our lives as moral people. And we don't need some other source of telling us what's right and wrong. We do it by our life experience and our knowledge and the people we come in contact with. I also might add that Unitarians are also, depending on which Unitarian church you go to, are good secular humanists also. So this is part of the community of humanists. There are, within my group, there are atheists, there are agnostics, there are deists, and there's a wide variety, but we also all judge you on the way you deal with other people, the way you deal with the world, and we don't use any external source of power.
Barry, thank you for the phone call. Good reminder. I mean, I really appreciate it. I mean, there's some remarkable diversity of ideas and community experience out there. And I thought that was a valuable phone call. But I also want to grab another phone call that kind of pushes back a little. Michael in Penfield. Go ahead, Michael.
Good morning. Afternoon, rather. I agree that ideas are to be debated and individuals respected. In the spirit of that, I'm not hearing any voices on your program of from those who are deeply religious and hold their faith dear to their hearts. And I think that's a disservice to the community. And unfortunately, I have to, with all due respect, and I do respect you and the program, but this happens far too often, that we're listening to one-sided discussions, and I would respectfully urge you to avoid that at all costs.
So, Michael, let me hang there for 1 second, because number one, I mean, I think you're raising an important point, and that producer Megan Mack and I work very hard on representation. We fail a lot. We do 500... I do. Let me put the failure on the host here. We do more than 500 hours a year. And there are times where we can't balance a panel or a discussion as much as I want. Sometimes we get a cancellation at the last second, and it all of a sudden things seem unbalanced. You know, the audience doesn't always know that. There are times where I think it's valuable to explore one particular side or an angle. And the reason that I will agree with your premise writ large today, but I'm going to disagree on this particular show, is should I put a Jain on the show? Should I have put a Christian, a Baptist, but not a Protestant? Should I have put a Jew, but not a Muslim? I mean, could a Muslim speak for all people of faith? Could a Baptist? Could a Christian Scientist, a Scientologist? I mean, like, what would be representative?
I understand your point, and your point is well taken, but it would be easy to find someone of faith to represent that train of thought, that idea, that devotion, okay, that way of life. And I would have a question for your panelist.
Sure.
Again, I don't remember the gentleman's name, but are you familiar with the Ten Commandments? I'm going to assume that you are, of course. Everyone is, probably. But if you live your life by the Ten Commandments, you know, then you are, in many respects, obeying a religion. Which, you know, the Ten Commandments are like the building blocks of, you know, the Catholic Church.
Yeah, Michael, thank you. Okay, Ten Commandments. Dan, do you live your life by the Ten Commandments?
Well, actually, the Ten Commandments represent principles that were around before Christianity. So you really can't claim that it is a Christian or Catholic, in this particular case, a principle. But let me get back to this idea of representation.
Yeah.
I think he makes a valid point.
I do too, by the way.
Everybody on this panel is either skeptic or a non-believer. But let me also push back that in our federal government, Congress, Senate, the Supreme Court,
yep,
in the executive branch, there's over 500 directly elected or appointed representatives at our federal system. None of them are self-identified as either atheist or agnostic, and atheists and agnostics together comprise about 7% of our total population. So when it comes to actual representation, atheists are woefully underrepresented, both in public speech and certainly when it comes to debate and policy and lawmaking in our country. So I think this show may be a very small attempt to bring balance to that.
Well, certainly. And right now, there's conversations about the Supreme Court appointment. And I mentioned this before the hour to our guests. I'm going to try to condense it because, I mean, the phones are still off the hook here, which is great. This has been a wonderful conversation. You've got a conversation about an open Supreme Court seat, and you've got a Republican president. It's going to be a conservative, probably an originalist, who's going to be appointed to this position. But the question in the public sphere is, should it be someone who is overtly religious and will overturn Roe on religious grounds? And some conservatives like David French, who I think is a wonderful writer and I think just absolutely valuable for what he writes for the for National Review, he thinks that the attacks on Amy Coney Barrett, who may get this appointment, have been by non-religious people who are bigoted against religious people. And Ross Douthat, a columnist for the New York Times, who's also a conservative and a traditionalist Catholic, pushed back this morning on David French and said, no, I think people are just essentially saying that she's going to live out her religious values. And that may mean overturning Roe on either originalist grounds or on religious grounds. And that we have to talk about that. And I feel like right now, Dan's point, I mean, John, is there any doubt right now that atheism is not really represented in the policy debate? And I guess the question is, what are the consequences and is that changing? I don't necessarily see that changing.
I haven't seen that change in the 20th century. A lot of polls have asked people, would you vote for someone who was a Catholic? Would you vote for someone who was whatever?
Yeah.
And atheist always turns out to be way, by far the worst possible.
Right near violent felons.
Right. Would you vote for a violent felon? Right.
Okay. So anybody else feel like that's changing? On the Supreme Court issue, Carol, you look at that. Do you have any anxiety that judges will be ruling based on sort of religious text alongside the law?
I have a lot of anxiety about that, yes. But back to the caller's question about whether we live by the Ten Commandments, I live by the Golden Rule, and I like to say my religion is kindness.
Yeah, kindness has been around forever, turns out. It has. Awesome. Andrew in Rochester, got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yes, yeah, so I grew up Catholic, so I just wanted to first thank the panel for kind of the courage to start coming out of the closet as an atheist, I guess. But more to the point of a question, I actually took a master's program in psychology, and they talked about how people who had religious beliefs ended up having higher levels of well-being, and they posited that it wasn't necessarily because of their religious beliefs in general, but because of the social community that it gets created. And we actually had to read a book by Alain de Botton, called Religion for Atheists, that talked about how we can recreate some of those social support structures in a non-religious future. And I was curious what the panelists' thoughts were on kind of creating a community of atheists or of practices.
Andrew, thank you. I'm horrified to see we're down to our last 2 minutes, but this is a great point. I mean, there's so many public benefits that come from organized religion in the way of building community, of connectivity, of support for different folks. And Andrew's absolutely right. So what do you do about that? I mean, Dan, you created a group trying to kind of do that, right?
Well, the Young Skeptics was trying to teach kids how to think critically. But yeah, there's the Atheist Community of Rochester. There's other groups that are trying to, as he suggested, replace that community. And I make the argument that, listen, religion evolved as a natural process for a reason. And one of those things is that type of community and spirit and togetherness that actually does add value.
Yeah.
Now, you don't need to bring all the other baggage along with it, but those things are important, and we need to preserve those.
Carol is the organizer of Secular Humanists of Rochester. You want to let people know what that is?
Yes, Meg, that's exactly why I started this organization just about 6 months ago. Because we try to provide a lot of the things that a church would provide. It's a place, in this case, where atheists and agnostics and any kind of non-believer, where people can come together and feel comfortable. Once a month, we have a discussion. Twice a month, we go out to restaurants just for fun and to gather with like-minded people. And we do a couple of community service projects too. We have a we volunteer at Foodlink, and we have an Adopt a Highway program. We pick up litter on along Blossom Road, and I think that these are many of the things that people want from a religious community.
Yeah, it's beautiful stuff. How do they get in contact with you, Carol? People want to get involved.
We're a meetup group, so well, they could Google
Secular Humanist Rochester,
or at meetup.com.
I am so sad to see this hour end. I will also say, going back to Michael's point on representation, you will, and you continue, you have, and you will in the future, as a listener of this program, hear the interfaith community of Rochester represented all the time. We've got such great friendships and people involved doing such wonderful work there. Different religious leaders occasionally from one religion talking about one specific subject, sometimes talking about issues that cross religious boundaries. So that'll continue. But the skeptical community, the atheist community, the humanist community, they will be invited too. And I hope we all can continue to have these discussions. And as Tony said, try to find out where people are, just for clarity, not because we're being hostile. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Wish we could all do this more often. We'll do that. More connections coming up.